Welcome back to Insights Now. My name is Mary Park Durham, and I'm a research associate on the Market Insights Strategy Team here at JP Morgan Asset Management. I'll be your host for this episode, and similar to last week's episode, David Kelly will be the interviewee. Before 2021, the United States hadn't seen a major bout of inflation for almost 40 years. And even when inflation peaked in June 2022, consensus estimates showed that most thought inflation would be almost back to 2% by the end of 2024. However, the journey to 2% has been more challenging than expected. Since mid-2023, inflation has remained in the 3 to 4% range, primarily due to persistently high shelter and auto insurance prices. This has caused the Fed to be on an extended pause. However, the latest CPI report brought some positive news, showing a month-over-month decline in prices for the first time in over a year. Year-over-year CPI inflation now sits at 3%, still well above a number consistent with the Fed's 2% target for the personal consumption deflator. In this episode, we will discuss if inflation can get back to its 2% target and the potential obstacles, and whether inflation even needs to be 2%. With this in the outlook for short-term interest rates being among the most dominant drivers of financial markets today, we think this discussion will be particularly useful. To help us dive deeper into these topics, I'm excited to be interviewing the show's host, Dr. David Kelly, Chief Global Strategist for JP Morgan Asset Management. Before we begin, if you're listening to the audio version of this podcast, you can now watch along on YouTube by tuning into our JP Morgan Asset Management channel, linked in the show notes. We have a lot to talk about, so let's get started. David, welcome back to the guest seat on Insights Now.
Glad to be here.
So David, for our first question, how did the Federal Reserve originally adopt its 2% target, especially considering the 50-year average for CPI is above that at 3.8%? And why is that the standard in most developed market countries?
So, yes, inflation has on average been higher than that. I think that's particularly because of the big inflation that we had in the 1970s and early 1980s. And of course, more recently, we've had a bout of inflation. So the Fed doesn't want to have those big bouts of inflation. So they want something lower. Historically, when did they come up with this number? It was actually in 1996. At an internal meeting in July of 1996, they agreed that they would try and target an inflation rate of 2%. And Alan Greenspan was running the Fed back then. But oddly enough, they didn't tell anybody. And so it actually remained as something of a secret that they'd actually agreed on this. They deliberately said, you know, you're sworn not to tell anybody that we're going to do a 2% target. But Alan Greenspan liked to keep things a little bit obscure. And Ben Bernanke, who took over from him, had really an opposite approach. He wanted to be as transparent as possible about what the Fed was doing. So in January of 2012, the Federal Reserve put out a statement of essentially longer-term statement on monetary policy principles. And there they said that they were going to try to target an inflation rate of 2% as measured by the personal consumption deflator. And that's what the target's been ever since. Why is it 2%? I think the argument is they've always had a goal of price stability, and that makes sense. Mm-hmm. You don't want, you know, inflation makes it very difficult to plan. People feel very grumpy if prices go up. When prices go up, it's the economy's fault. When your wages go up, it's because you're rather brilliant, and of course you deserve a raise. But people get very, very grumpy when prices go up. And so the economy doesn't work well with 5 or 6 or 7 or 8 or 9% on inflation, but it doesn't work well with zero either. Mm-hmm. Because, and from the Federal Reserve's perspective, the thing that they worried about is, well, if you've got a positive inflation rate of about 2%, and then you cut short-term interest rates down to zero, then you've got negative real rates. And negative real rates, in their way of thinking, stimulates the economy. So if you had no inflation at all, it'd be kind of impossible for them to stimulate the economy because it's hard to push real rates or push nominal interest rates much below zero. And so I kind of get that. Mm-hmm. I don't really agree with them, but that's the way they see it. So they wanted a positive number. I think another way of looking at it is, in an economy where you've got a little bit of productivity growth, nobody likes to take a wage cut in a year. But if you had zero inflation, then actually some people would have to get a wage cut every year and some people get wage increases. And that's not really good either. So 2% is about right, we think. Mm-hmm. Honestly, does it make much difference, 3% or 1%? No. But 2% is about right. And I think the last thing is central banks want people to believe that they're headed for 2% inflation because that gives people inflation expectations are very important. So if everybody expects 2% inflation, well, you can plan around that. You put in your spreadsheets. And so it's a nice low round number. And I think that's why the Federal Reserve and other central banks target it.
Yes, there's no magic to the 2% number, but it gives them a nice buffer to avoid, you know, dipping where prices turn negative.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. And as I mentioned earlier, shelter and auto prices have been the one, or auto insurance prices have been the ones keeping inflation particularly sticky. Yeah. And it made up around 80% of the headline figure in June.
Yep.
So why do you think that these two components are particularly sticky?
Well, I think it's, to be honest, it's just a measurement issue.
Mm-hmm.
On shelter is really weird because I think the shelter accounts for about 34%, or actually, sorry, 36% of the CPI. So mm-hmm. a big chunk of the CPI is just shelter. And I get it that the economists at the Bureau of Labor Statistics feel like, well, housing's pretty important in terms of people's spending, so it should be a big chunk. But then the question is, well, how do you deal with housing? You don't want to just use the increase in home prices, because after all, if home prices go up, most people are pretty happy because they own a home and just went up in value.
Mm-hmm.
So they don't want to do that. They don't want to use mortgage payments because some people pay mortgages, some people don't, although I think that might actually be a better measure. So what they do is they say, okay, for people who are actually renting, it's easy enough. We're going to look at rents. But for everybody who owns a home, we're going to say, okay, let's pretend you're renting out your home. Yeah, I know you're not renting out, but if you did rent out your home, how much would you rent it for? And that's what's called owner's equivalent rent. And the only way they can really calculate owner's equivalent rent is actually looking at what's going on in the rental market. So this whole 34% is really getting pushed by the government's measure of what's going on in the rental market. Now, even that has got a problem with it, because if you're going to do that, the right way to do it is think about leases that were just signed in the last month. That's not what they do. They survey a whole pile of people and they come back to them 6 months later or a year later and say, okay, so, you know, I know we talked to you in the past, and so how much has your rent gone up in the last 6 months or last year, relative to the last time we talked to you? And that means the whole thing's going to lag. And we look at year-over-year numbers also, and that also makes it lag. So when you look at that, the government's measure of rent and owner's equivalent rent has fallen, but it's still up at around 5.5% year-over-year. We know that actual new leases are being signed with increases of about, say, 3% year over year. So we know that eventually this is going to come down, but it's just taking its sweet time doing so. And so we're tracking it out. It has been coming down. We think it'll come down, but it probably won't get down to sort of market measures until sometime in 2025. Then with auto insurance, it's a little bit of a similar problem. There were things that pushed up auto insurance costs a lot, more litigation expenses, more expensive equipment. You couldn't find repair workers, so repair costs went up. All of these things pushed auto insurance up a lot. But also the way the government measures it, they don't look at, okay, new auto insurance contracts being signed. They look at the book of business that auto insurance companies have and look at that relative to what it was some time back. But of course, that includes a lot of old policies. So again, it takes a long time for auto insurance increases to feed through the system. So right now, we've got this 5.5% increase in shelter costs, which is too high. We've got a 20% increase year over year in auto insurance costs. And I know they're up a lot, but I think this is somewhat lagging reality. But either way, we expect both of those to come down over the next year. And that's going to bring the overall inflation rate down to 2%. So inflation is still cooling. It's just cooling slowly.
Mm-hmm. It definitely seems like there are some flaws in the way the government measures inflation.
Yeah, and there are flaws in all of these economic data. Mm-hmm. And that's why I think it's very important for the Federal Reserve and for investors not to be too wedded to the headline numbers, but to really look at what's really going on here. What I think is interesting is if you look at the goods sector, mm-hmm. it really is just much less inflation there. You know, energy costs, core goods prices, food prices. All the inflation there has basically gone away after a big surge in inflation. Now, I haven't said the prices have come down. The prices stay high, but the rate of change of prices has really collapsed in 2023 and 2024. And so that tells us the economy's sort of headed back towards 2% inflation.
Got it. And speaking of inflation measures, the Fed actually uses the personal consumption deflator, not CPI, even though that's what the headlines and the news media is focused on, to track inflation. So it has been hovering above 2% for some time. It's below CPI. So do you feel like this is low enough for the Fed to feel like the inflation fight is over?
It's getting there. So we're recording this before we actually get the number for the June consumption deflator. The May consumption deflator was up 2.6% year over year. We think that the June number is going to come in something like 2.4% year over year. 2.4%, 2%, it's pretty close. So I think that should be close enough for the Fed to ease. I do think that it's going to, based on what we're seeing in terms of auto insurance and shelter costs and so forth, it will continue to come down. So but just come down slowly. So we think that we will at some stage, in maybe later this year, but certainly in 2025, see a 2.0% reading on the consumption deflator. But it does take some time to come down. Again, what I think the Federal Reserve ought to look at is not just what's going on in the inflation numbers here, but also in the various marketplaces. What's going on with new vehicle prices? What's going on with gasoline prices? What's going on with food prices? And look at where demand meets supply in the economy. Are we really suffering from too much demand? I mean, if we're suffering from too much demand, then maybe the Federal Reserve needs to be tight. But if that's not the case, if demand has really come in alignment with supply, and we're just looking at statistical quirks in the data that's keeping it from hitting 2%, the Federal Reserve ought to be willing to normalize interest rates.
Yes, and now it seems like they're more comfortable with cutting rates before necessarily their preferred indicator reaches 2%, which is good news.
Well, that's right. And one of the, Jay Powell was asked about this at a press conference a while back, and he pointed out that you really do need to cut rates before then, because monetary policy operates with a lag. And again, I might differ with them a little bit on exactly how it's affecting the economy. But by their framework, monetary policy works with a lag. So if you wait until you hit 2% before you cut rates, you're almost certainly going to go below 2% before you normalize rates. So it's important for them to begin to normalize rates well in advance of actually hitting that 2% target. That's what the Fed has said. I think they've been cautious about doing this because, frankly, the economy's been pretty strong. But as the economy cools down a bit and as inflation edges towards that 2% number, we think that they will be ready to go starting in September.
That makes sense. And after this cycle of inflation is over, we don't even want to think about the next cycle. We're hoping that inflation remains low and steady for a long time. But in the future, what do you perhaps see as the biggest inflationary risk to the economy or to the global economy that investors should be aware of?
Well, I think there are a few things. I think one thing the thing that causes inflation more than anything else is either a big decline in supply or big increase in demand. So one issue that if we have some shock to energy supplies around the world, if the U.S. got into a war with Iran and the Persian Gulf was shut down, then that would cause global oil prices to spike and lead to inflation. Or we could have just more populist politics. I mean, we're both under the Biden administration and under the Trump administration, the federal government poured money at lower middle-income consumers. And it didn't make economic sense. It did make economic sense, of course, to help people who were actually jobless. Mm-hmm. But it did not make, both of my sons got stimulus checks in the last recession, and they were both working very hard, harder than they've ever worked, and earning good money. So it didn't make sense to do this. But we've got to worry about populist politics. I mean, the problem is, if you look at the end game for populist politics, is the government always spends too much money. It co-opts the Federal Reserve. It tells them they're not able to run the show. And then they pour money at the population. The population likes getting the money, and they blame somebody else for the inflation. And so, that's how Argentina ended up having the kind of economy it's had. So that's another risk, is that we just lose control of fiscal discipline altogether. So these are things to worry about. I will say, though, that outside of those things, I'm not that worried about inflation, because the long-term trend is it's actually been getting more competitive. The trade union movement has declined over time, so wage growth is not that strong. You've got a lot of competition because of online technology. You can buy the cheapest thing very easily. And then you've got income inequality. So much money ends up in the hands of the richest. They don't tend to buy goods and services much. They actually buy financial assets. And, people who are poorer would like to buy a lot of goods and services, but none of the money. And that tends to pull down inflation, too. So I think the long-term trend in inflation is lower, but we still got to be vigilant to make sure that we don't stoke it again.
Exactly. There's always inflationary forces, but also there's deflationary forces.
Yes.
So hopefully in the long run, we can see better balance.
Yep.
And my last question is about investing. Mm-hmm. With your expectation of lower inflation from here and a potential start to the Fed rate cutting cycle in September, how should investors prepare?
Well, I think lower inflation, first of all, I think, getting back to your last question, there is a risk at some stage of a renewal of inflation. If you want to protect yourself against inflation, real assets make a lot of sense. Real estate, you have to be careful what real estate you buy. It's always a matter of the property. But real estate, other physical assets are good protection against inflation. Stocks are a better protection, obviously, than bonds. Because stocks are a claim on a real asset, the real output of a company. So I think that's how you protect against inflation. If inflation's coming down, that should help stocks to some extent. But I think people need to be just a little careful about this, because it seems like we've been discounting declining inflation and discounting a few Fed rate cuts for a long time here. And the financial markets have got a nasty habit of betting on something and then doubling the bet and then doubling the bet and doubling the bet. So you could end up with a market that's way overvalued, even if the scenario turns out okay. And so I think, again, back to, you know, I think people need to think about diversifying. And thinking about valuations. Make sure you're not buying a whole pile of stuff that is just patently overvalued or worthless. Things like meme stocks and Bitcoin and so forth. Don't get into that. try to, and even in stocks in general, look at markets and individual stocks and funds which have reasonable PE ratios. I think that's part of the protecting yourself. And then obviously also just diversify, because you don't know whether the next shock is an inflationary shock or a deflationary shock. I guess, you know, people ask me about growth, and you've asked me about growth, and you've asked me about inflation, about the economy overall. And, you know, the U.S. economy is a pretty strong economy. It's quite capable of looking after itself, to be honest. It's just under no obligation to look after the average investor. And that's why I think it's so important that investors work with financial advisors and think about what they need to do to protect your portfolio, even if the economy turns out to be okay. Because it's quite possible the economy be okay in terms of growth and in terms of inflation, and still you could have a significant market correction, and you just want to be on the right side of that correction if it occurs.
Definitely. So I think that's all the time we have for today. David, thank you very much for sharing your insights. On our next episode, join David for a discussion on the federal debt and its implications for the U.S. economy and markets. Until then, check out David's Notes on the Week Ahead podcast, where every Monday he shares commentary on the latest in the markets and economy to help you stay informed for the week ahead. For even more timely insights, you can also follow and subscribe to David's content on LinkedIn. To all our viewers and listeners, thank you for tuning in today, and speak with you soon.
This content is intended for information only, based on assumptions and current market conditions, and are subject to change. No warranty of accuracy is given. This content does not contain sufficient information to support investment decisions. It is not to be construed as research, legal, regulatory, tax, accounting, or investment advice. Investments involve risks. Investors should seek professional advice or make an independent evaluation before investing. The value of investments and the income from them may fluctuate, including loss of capital. Past performance and yield are not indicative of current or future results. Forecasts and estimates may or may not come to pass. J.P. Morgan Asset Management is the asset management business of J.P. Morgan Chase & Company and its affiliates worldwide.